come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith, who just came out with a new memoir called Ordinary Light. And it is a beautiful book about childhood, about family, and about language. You're going to love this book. And of course, if you know her work, you know how amazing she is, what an amazing poet she is. Stick around. We're going to talk to Tracy K. Smith. Tracy K. Smith is author of three books of poetry: The Body's Question, winner of the Kav Kanam Poetry Prize, Duende, winner of the James Laughlin Award, and her most recent, Life on Mars, winner of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize. Yes, I did say Pulitzer Prize. And it was also a New York Times notable book. Her honors include a Wallace Stegner Fellowship, a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writing Award, a Whitting Writers Award, and an Academy of American Poets Fellowship. She teaches creative writing at Princeton University, and this is her first book of prose, Ordinary Light, a memoir. Tracy, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this wonderful book, Ordinary Light. You are known, of course, as a poet. You have three books of poems, I believe. In fact, I used Duende in one of my poetry workshops. But this is your first memoir. Can you tell us how and why this came about?
Oh, sure. I'd really wanted to write about the death of my mother. She passed away just after I'd graduated from college, after having dealt with cancer for 4 years. That was a loss that I wanted to find a way of exploring and making sense of from, you know, right away. But I found it difficult to get any headway in the material. I think for a long time I felt overwhelmed by it. I did end up writing a number of poems about her when I was in graduate school, but there was something about the wish to explore those events in prose and maybe in a way speak back to our relationship and to her that I kept wanting to do. And it wasn't until I became a mother that perhaps the material presented itself to me in a way that was inviting. And feel like some of the questions that I had became clarified for me, probably because I was also thinking about answering them or exploring them, not just for me, but for my children.
Right. My mom died of cancer when she was 48 years old, and when I was reading your prologue with the family surrounding her, it kind of evoked that memory for me, and I still haven't been able to write about it. How long did it take you before you were able to really write about that moment?
That scene was not one of the first ones that I wrote at all. I wanted to go back to the beginning, to my childhood, and to thinking about our relationship and the language that we shared and the things that she had imparted to me. And once I did that and was able to move forward and even examine those first months living with the reality of her diagnosis and the questions that it triggered, only then did I feel brave enough to kind of tackle some of the really painful and visceral memories of that experience. I put off writing that scene for a long time, and for a long time I thought maybe I could get away with not having it in the book. And then I realized that there was something really beautiful about being able to slow that moment down and move around within it in a way that I couldn't have done in real time, because the emotions were, you know, paralyzing in a way. It was really helpful. And once I'd written it, I realized that it might be helpful for the reader to know from the beginning that this was really the trigger for the whole story.
Your father was a scientist, and your mother was very religious. She was a Christian. And I'm wondering how this kind of dichotomy of science and religion work together to help you create the way you see reality.
I think it did have an effect. My father was an engineer and was really interested in logic and order and exploring the natural world and using, you know, these proofs and theorems to understand what else was available to us to make and change in the world. But he was also a man of faith. I grew up going to church with both my parents and my siblings my whole life, you know, when I was their child at home. I think my dad's perspective was tempered by the fact that he did have these other belief systems, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think he was very comfortable allowing the ordered world to shape and temper his sense of belief in God and the beyond. I think in my family, and I think in a lot of families, church going is partly something that has to do with feeding our spiritual selves, but it's also something that helps keep order and a sense of like the family community and a sense of the family's place within the larger social community. And I think that that was something that might have shaped my father's take on belief. My mother's was really about being devout and confiding in God and leaning on God for help. But I think she was also somebody who understood that a family can be held together by having certain rituals.
Yeah, even though you were in a family of seven, you were the youngest, and most of your, well, your siblings were already adults when you were growing up, and so you were almost like an only child.
Yeah, I feel like I had the best of both worlds. You know, those moments when everybody came home were so joyful, and I looked forward to them with such eagerness. But then there were these quiet stretches where, you know, I was alone, and I could think and imagine, and I feel like that probably, in some ways, made me a writer.
Right. And speaking of when everybody was home, they were all off to college or, you know, doing their own thing, living their own lives. But when they came home, all seven of you in the house, that was a time for you of intense peace during the daytimes. But at night, something weird happened. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I should preface this by saying that I grew up in California in the 70s and 80s. And at one point in the mid-80s, there was a serial killer whose name was Richard Ramirez.
Right, I remember him.
Before he was caught, he was known as the Night Stalker. And reports of the terrible things he did, you know, just gripped me with a terrible kind of cold sweat fear because of, you know, the danger that somebody like that posed, but mostly because it alerted me to this idea that we were all vulnerable. You know, my family could go away one day, who would I be? I don't know that I was afraid that this person was going to come strangle me, but I was worried that I would be somebody who was alone in the world without the people that made the world worthwhile.
And that's what I find interesting about that fear that, you know, you would, like, somebody's going to break into the house and, you know, Richard Ramirez or somebody like him. But you only had that fear when your brothers and sister were in the house, not when you were alone. And it's like your fear was for them, you know, as opposed to, you know, fear for yourself. Like when I was a kid and I used to be scared to be in my room alone, every creaking, every settling of the house, I thought was a kidnapper to come in and get me. But I was afraid for myself. You were afraid for them, which really kind of shows your sense of family right from the beginning was just incredibly strong.
I feel that way now, too. I think a lot of parents do, but sometimes that night fear will come, and it's about the children. Like, oh, right. You know, how could I go on? It's selfish, though. It's about saying, how could I enjoy life without the people that really make life valuable for me.
Your father would introduce you to books, and he introduced you to Shakespeare's sonnets and to Man-Child in a Promised Land. I remember reading that when I was in high school, not as young as you were, but I remember I was in high school when I read that. All these just wonderful literary books that allow your imagination to expand, allow your world to expand, whereas your mother introduced you to the series of book called Little Visits from God, which seemed to have more of a singular reason behind them, which is to build morality, to build faith. And how do you think the contrast of those two literary experiences, you know, fed you in how you see literature and how you see poetry?
Well, I think though, even the, you know, the Little Visits with God, it crafted all of these ideas about being a good child and listening to God and obeying your parents into small stories, you know, where the children were characters and the events that were unfolding in the world around them, but also giving them access to, you know, this Heavenly Father. I don't think that was all that different from the way that a novel might work, where, you know, there's a character on the ground in his life and there are the forces of fate that bring certain opportunities to him or that, you know, thrust him into some terrible kind of problem. And, maybe the stories made both of those things feel real to me. Both kinds of worlds feel real and possible, and also, I guess, exciting. I didn't feel drudgery reading these, you know, like kind of moralistic Christian stories.
You seem to enjoy them. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe I was a goody two shoes as a little kid, but I think part of it had to do with the way that words can make things feel relevant and private and specific to you, even if they're, you know, written for somebody who was born decades or centuries before.
Well, it seems with both texts, you were able to learn at a very young age how to enter into the landscape, an imaginative landscape, a fictional landscape. You were there. And the effect that this had on you, or this ability that you developed, ultimately, when you would hear about the revelation, you would hear about the second coming, it was all very cruel, but yet at the same time kind of perhaps theoretical, you know, an idea, until you read it yourself. And when you read it yourself, you really entered into that landscape and had a profound effect on you. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. It's funny what it takes for us to realize. You know, I don't think I understood these tendencies in myself until I wrote about them. But once I did, I could remember the incredible sense of betrayal that I felt as a kid one afternoon just deciding to read the book of Revelation. I was probably like 8 or 9 years old, not necessarily the intended audience, but feeling like, you know, okay, if the world comes to us in terms of narratives and possibilities, this seems like a total disruption of the narrative that I had been taught to believe about a benevolent God and about a world where goodness can thrive and prosper and be rewarded. That book, which I've, you know, since had the opportunity to look at in more historical terms, but at the time reading it as either narrative, adventure, or fact, because I think I was kind of urged to consider it as fact, I was completely decentered and terrified, and I felt like something must be wrong. Something must be wrong if this is what the God of the Old Testament is going to turn into by the end of days.
Yeah. You come to probably all the time, because I read your poetry, and sometimes I'm amazed at where the language takes me. I'm wondering if there were times in writing this memoir that just really took you by surprise.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, I want to say that definitely. For me, the act of writing is really rooted in the wish for some sort of discovery. And it can't be something that I have, you know, decided will happen. So the work itself, if it's going to succeed, it has to surprise or contradict some kind of expectation that I might have had. And I think that happened in the writing of this book as well. For one thing, looking backwards at my life, kind of revealed that there was a through line, and that the things that I had experienced in the moment that felt random or haphazard might, over the long span, have been working toward something that looks like a coherent narrative. That was surprising and really consoling, and I didn't know that was one of the aims that I might have had when I set out to write, but I wonder if it might have been. Mm-hmm. But something else that I hadn't expected was that I would have so much that I wanted to say about race. I'm surprised that race is relevant, but I didn't realize how much of my life had been characterized by silence around that topic, by a fear of hearing the true stories about what my parents' experiences in the South during like Jim Crow might have been, out of like fear of naming or claiming something that might be true for me and yet difficult or even challenging for somebody who was not like me. All of the tensions and realizations that had to do with race that I had as I was growing up happened inside my head. Sometimes in my family we would talk about it, but again, that was within the safety and the shelter of family. And writing this book forced me to bring a lot of those feelings and realizations into language. And I hadn't expected it, but I was really really grateful for that opportunity.
Like there was a time when your high school counselor, or maybe it was a junior high counselor, I don't remember exactly, said, Tracy, you're going to get lots of opportunities because of who you are. And I mean, who wouldn't want to hear that, right? Like, oh, yeah, thanks. You know, I mean, that's all my hard work. And all, but then he meant something a little bit more subtle than that. Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, yeah, this was one of my high school teachers. And I don't think he was setting out to discourage or hurt me at all, but to say, look, you as an African-American young woman are going to be given certain opportunities because of who you are, and you should be willing to take right. advantage of them. It didn't jibe with the things that my father had taught us, right? Like, you've got to do your best, be your best, earn every opportunity, show the world how indispensable you are. So all of the effort that, you know, I was making to do that seemed to be squelched by the suggestion that affirmative action might also be beneficial to someone like me, even if that's not what it's called, you know.
Right.
So there was a little tension that I felt, you know, especially that next year getting admitted to colleges and feeling like, how much of this did I earn and how much is it about the box that I can check on my application? I feel like I'm not so troubled by that now.
Right.
I feel like I'm clear on the things that I might have been offered
right.
by luck, and clear on the things that I feel like I've deserved through work and effort. But as a kid, that's kind of a dizzying proposition to consider, along with
right,
everything
right.
else that adolescents are working through.
Yeah, I remember when I first got a TA ship in grad school, and I was teaching freshman comp for the first time, and you know, the first one in my family to go to college and all that, and I'm every suggestion I got that it was affirmative action, I fought it. But after a while, I thought, you know what? Good. Let it be affirmative action, damn it. I deserve
yeah.
to be here on more levels than just my efforts.
Exactly. And then there's always a sense, well, if that's what it is, I'll make good on that.
Right,
know?
Right. And then you had a couple of more incidents when you got into Berkeley, a white kid who also applied and hadn't heard yet and said, well, of course you'd get in, of course implying that you got in because you're African-American. And then there was a friend, a young woman you wanted to befriend in high school, but she would always refer to you as, hey, black girl. And somehow when you referred to her as, hey, white girl, it didn't resonate quite the same way.
Right.
And these are obviously, you know, very subtle, benign introductions to difference, to other, to racism. But I'm wondering how many of these experiences, which must have bothered you, would bother anybody, made you think more about your parents and their experience in the South, especially your mother growing up in Alabama, and then your grandmother who was called mother, you know, how much it kind of connected you.
Oh, gosh, yeah. You know, because I recoiled from those kinds of hard realizations in the moment, I think I compartmentalized a lot of things and said, this is what's happening to me, but it's just, you know, an aberration. And the fear of the history that my parents belonged to was sat in another room in my mind, if you will. But writing about these things created a kind of synthesis, or alerted me to a synthesis,
mm-hmm.
Or a through line. And that was really exciting, not only because of, you know, it links me and my experience to my parents and grandparents and fosters a different kind of empathy, but it also makes me think of, you know, the history that we as Americans are in the process of experiencing and affecting. And because my kids sit on that same continuum, it's something that I'm happy to have brought mm-hmm. into, you know, like palpable form for myself. And I think it's something I really want to continue to write about. We are in the midst of a moment in 2015 where the distance between now and, you know, like Jim Crow era, it feels shorter than it ought to. You know, all of these crimes and botched legal decisions that have raised our sense of questioning how much we really love one another and regard one another as citizens. And these are things that a child doesn't have language for, but I think a child feels in a way.
We're talking to Tracy K. Smith, author of Ordinary Light, a new memoir. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Thank you.
I wish you the best of luck on this book. It's awesome. I'm wondering, we have this segment called Poem of the Week, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to read a short poem.
Oh, I'd love to.
Oh, awesome. That would be great.
Let's see, I'm sitting at my desk. I'm just going to pull a poem down from my book, Duende.
Oh, which is the one I used in my graduate course.
Oh, great.
Yes, I loved it.
Thanks. This is for the Brazilian poet Adelia Prado, and it's called In Brazil. Poets swagger up and down the shore, I'll bet, wagging their hips in time to the raucous tide. They tip back their heads and life sears a path down the throat. At night, they dance, don't they, across tiles that might as well be glass or ice. And if they don't want to spend the evening alone, they don't. And if they want to wear snow angels into the sheets of some big empty bed, that's what they do, until a dark form takes shape on the ceiling overhead. Then they put on a robe and kick around looking for some slippers. When the poem finally arrives, it grins and watches back with wide, credulous eyes.
That was Tracy K. Smith, author of Ordinary Light. Tracy, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
I'm Azucena Dominguez, and I'm a retired teacher, and right now I'm part of Tumbleword's Writing Project. This story is about when I was a senior in high school. Yearning for a first date. I was a senior in high school, and I could only see my boyfriend, Alberto, at school, as my father did not allow me to date at all. Alberto was getting more disappointed about the fact that all his friends went out on weekends with their girlfriends, and from the group, we were the only ones who never did. I reminded him that I had told him from the beginning that I could not go out on dates because of my father's strictness. That day, he said that it was ridiculous, especially since I was a senior in high school, and that he wanted to talk to my father and ask him permission to take me to a movie. The next weekend, the movie, The Graduate, was coming to the Silver City Theater, and a bunch of our friends were planning to go on that Saturday evening to see it. Alberto kept insisting on going to my home and asking my dad for permission. I told him that if he showed up at my home, he would get me in so much trouble and definitely make matters worse. I promised that I would ask my father on Monday and try to convince him to let me go. On Monday, I started a conversation with my dad about how it was my last year in high school and I had yet to go on a first date. I then told him about the group planning to go see a movie at the downtown theater on that coming Saturday, and if I could please have his permission to go. He immediately said no, and that why did I want to be like those mujeres sueltas, or loose women. I said that I wanted just to go to a movie theater, as normal high school kids did. Every morning and every evening, I begged, cried, and tried to persuade my father to let me go this one time and that I would not ask again. Each time, he would adamantly say no and repeat that I wanted to become a wild woman. I reminded him how I had good grades in school and how I would do all the house chores and had never given him any problems. His answer was still no. Friday morning, the day before the movie, I begged and begged my father to let me go. I don't know if I tired him out, but he said he was going to let me go this one time, but not to think that it meant there would be other times. I was ecstatic, and I didn't even care about the last part at that moment. I went to school, almost floating on air, and told my boyfriend my happy news. Alberto could not believe it at first, but I assured him that it was true. He then proceeded to tell me that we would be double dating with Ernie and Graciela, one of his best buddies who had a car, and she was one of my best friends too. I felt I was the happiest girl on our high school campus that Friday. When I got home after school, my dad informed me that our washing machine had stopped functioning and that I would have to go wash our clothes at a laundromat in Bayard, a nearby town, as our little town of Hanover only had a post office and a gas station. I said that was fine and nothing could wipe that big smile off my face. Bayard was where our high school was and where my friend Graciela lived. Right away, I thought of a plan to go visit her. I placed the three baskets of laundry in my dad's car and headed to the laundromat in Bayard. I put the clothes in 3 washing machines, asked the attendant if I could leave for 30 minutes and come back to place the loads in the dryers. I drove over to Graciela's home, and she lived on top of a hill. I parked the car right in front of her house on the gravel shoulder and ran in, all giddy. We were talking about what to wear and where to eat before the movie. I was just so happy when I realized it had been 45 minutes already, and I dashed to the laundromat, placed the clothes in the dryers, and went back to Graciela's to talk a little more. 30 minutes later, I told her that I needed to go and that I would see her the next day on our double date. As I started the car, I was looking to my left to make sure to let the cars go by. I did notice that my car was slowly coasting forward since I was on top of the hill. As I turned my face forward, one of the cars had just parked right in front of me, and I slammed the brakes. However, because of the gravel, my car skidded a little, and I bumped the car in front of me. The lady driver came out of her car yelling at the top of her lungs. I tried to explain what happened, but she would not let me. Her daughter was with her, and they both were accusing me of hitting their car purposely. They called the police, who got there right away. I told the policeman that I was being careful and was letting the cars go by. I exclaimed, "Suddenly, she was right in front of me." The policeman believed me and did not give me a ticket. However, he said I had to call my father. We didn't even have a phone at home, so I had to call the neighbor's home from Graciela's. Later, my dad showed up, and the lady started yelling at him. There was only a scratch on the back of her car. My dad told her that she could take it to this place that he knew to fix the scratch. She said no, that she would take it to a more expensive place. Then my dad dealt with me. He asked what I was doing there when I should be at the laundromat and asked where the clothes were. I explained that the clothes were in the dryers and that I had come to visit Graciela while they were washing and drying. I could tell that my father was quite upset. We left the scene of the accident after the policeman said it was okay. Needless to say, after my accident, I didn't get to go on my first date. My dad had to pay $400 for the lady's car damage, as she did take it to the most expensive body shop in town. He said that I had the accident because I had disobeyed him. That Friday, I went from being the happiest girl to being the saddest girl. For Words on a Wire, this is Azucena Dominguez.
I'd like to thank Tracy K. Smith, author of Ordinary Light, for joining us here on Words on a Wire. And we talked to her from her offices at Princeton University, where she teaches creative writing. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join me every week on Words on a Wire. And I'm going to end with a quote from James Baldwin. And this is the quote that Tracy K. Smith uses to open up her memoir. But something deep and watchful in the child knows that this is bound to end, is already ending. In a moment, someone will get up and turn on the light.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy, a railroad.